This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 319 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hey, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everyone. This week I'm in beautiful downtown Wichita, Kansas for the Bombardier safety stand down, and I'm getting safer all the time, I think, since I'm here.
You've been to those before, right? This is an annual event that Bombardier puts on?
It's an annual safety event for people involved in the business aviation world, pilots, flight attendants, department managers. We all just kind of schmooze about how to make things safer. So, and it's going to take us until Thursday night to get that figured out.
Good, good. Maybe next time you can give us a little report. Tell us how it went.
10-4, I will do. I mean, Roger, sorry. Okay. Wrong code.
Also with us is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Hey, Rob. Greetings from Philadelphia. We're sitting here getting ready for a quiet evening. Unfortunately, my plans to go to Las Vegas due to issues didn't happen, but surprise, Australia has decided to come to me, so I'm looking forward to seeing my good friend Mr. Vischer tonight as he arrives at Philadelphia International Airport.
So you're going to be hosting him in Philly?
Yeah, so that's a bit of a surprise, but we're making it happen.
Great. Well, our guest this episode is Rachel Payne. Rachel's from Florida Aircraft Salvage and Transport, also called Fast Aviation, which is an aircraft salvage company in Sanford, Florida. Rachel, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
And thank you so much for having me.
Now, coming up, we're going to talk with Rachel about this interesting aspect of aviation, the used parts business, the salvage business, what that involves, and particularly with respect to general aviation. But Rachel, you've been in this business for quite a while now, 10 years or so, something like that?
Yeah, I've been doing it since, I've been around it my whole entire life because my father, but I started selling airplane parts online when I was 14.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, we're looking forward to exploring that part of the aviation industry with you. As always, though, we're going to start off with some current aviation news, including an update on the Chicago Air Traffic Control Center shutdown. Also, Boeing has been warning about hackers. Also, product liability issues, how they affect aviation, and the debut of the Sikorsky S-97 attack helicopter. Now, David, for this week's history segment, what are we looking at?
I'm going to impart a story about what happened while I was down at Oceana. I took the Saturday off from air showing, and I made a pilgrimage to a place that's very special, namely Kitty Hawk, North Carolina.
And we have an Australia desk coming up. Grant's flying solo again. He talks about the Martin Jetpack Company going for an IPO, some problems with CASA's recent introduction of Part 61 licenses, how the RAF will fit their two new C-17s into the available space at RAF Base Amberley. In the Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson talks to Mick Oakley, the managing editor of The Aviation Historian. And as always, we've got some fantastic listener mail, and we'll close out with that. All right, so if everyone's ready, we'll get started with the aviation news.
Hey,
Hey, let's start off talking about the fire in Chicago. Rob, you've been following this pretty closely. In fact, you've got an article out on this Chicago Biz Av traffic moving following ATC Center fire. What's the latest on this?
Well, the fellow that is alleged to have done this, I never quite understood what the alleged was all about when they kind of caught the guy red-handed. I guess he still gets a trial, so the fact that you were caught with the gasoline and all that. But anyway, we'll go down another road, but traffic is moving better in Chicago these days. I had a chance to test it out yesterday when I left Midway coming to Wichita, but I did know... I did notice that they kept us down lower coming out of Midway, and it was a much more gradual climb than I have seen for traffic leaving the Chicago area. But, of course, we still have center controllers stashed at the Chicago Tracon, which runs all the traffic in and out of O'Hare, at a couple of satellite airports at Rockford, at South Bend, at Milwaukee. And also at all the adjoining centers, Minneapolis, Indianapolis, Cleveland, and Kansas City. And they're basically trying to run traffic from all those locations and keep everything coordinated. And so far, they're doing a pretty decent job. They really are. Most people are fairly patient about the delays. And the only thing we don't know at this point is whether or not the FAA is going to live up to its deadline, its self-imposed deadline of getting everything back on track by October 13th. That's yet to be confirmed.
So is it the FAA that's got to replace the damaged equipment?
That's a really interesting question. My guess is that since that was a Harris contractor, somebody at FAA, please tell me this as a taxpayer, somebody said, well, that guy worked for you. We're not paying for that. But I would imagine that this is the cost of this one's going to be off the charts.
And hopefully any kind of resolution as to who's going to pay or all of that, hopefully that won't hold up getting the place back in shape. Because until it's rebuilt, we're kind of stuck with the situation we have now. Is that right?
That's really true. They have a system, I'm sorry, they have a phrase they use. It's called ATC Zero, and that essentially means that Chicago Center or any ATC facility is unable to provide the service that is expected out of it. And Chicago Center has been ATC Zero since the 26th of September, and still ATC Zero. So we're... you know, again, we're hoping it's going to come back. But, of course, the other issue is how do they protect themselves from this kind of thing happening again and then multiply that by 20 other in-route centers around the country, because most of these buildings are organized pretty much the same way. So, you know, that means they are potentially all vulnerable.
Right. I imagine that there'll be some interesting lessons learned that will be applied to the other centers and maybe other aspects of air traffic control to kind of harden it in the future.
Well, we'll see. But again, the controllers have really done a really decent job in trying to make this all work.
Great. Okay. All right, let's move on to the next item. This comes from the Runway Girl Network. This is an article by Carrie Reels. Boeing urges airlines to be vigilant of cybersecurity threats. Now, as we talk about frequently over there at the Runway Girl Network, airliners are becoming increasingly networked, both for the benefit of the passengers with in-flight entertainment systems and internet in the sky, but also for airline operational purposes. They kind of term it the planes are being e-enabled, if you will. Well, at the recent Aircraft Commerce Magazine's conference in London, John Craig, the Boeing's chief engineer of cabin and network solutions, he gave the industry a warning. He said, don't ignore cybersecurity. He says there's lots of opportunities out there for hackers as these aircraft become more and more e-enabled. I guess this isn't really a surprise. But, you know, here again, we've got, you know, one more opportunity for a threat to creep in.
I think that's what I said, too, when I read this. Really? I mean, the CEOs are in need of counseling that their aircraft could be susceptible to being hacked? Really?
One interesting thing from this article is kind of the approach that the airline industry takes. I think what the author here is saying is that the airline industry is used to sort of a process of see a problem, study the problem to understand root cause, implement a solution that prevents recurrence, then the problem is solved and you can move on. You don't have to worry about that anymore. But that's really not the case when you're talking about cybersecurity. You have to be constantly vigilant, and it's a different way of thinking about keeping the you know, the operation safe.
But wouldn't you think, and I don't know, I'll throw this open to anybody, but wouldn't you think that in this day and age, that if you were running an airline, that you would be saying something like, what are the kinds of problems we could face that we haven't faced yet? Or let's just throw some darts at a dartboard of issues and just think about some really far out stuff and try to figure out if it's really possible.
You mean threat analysis?
Threat analysis. I love that concept.
Well, you're the safety expert. Why don't you convince the airlines that it's part of safety? Well, if they're going to hack into aircraft, I mean, that's been a scenario in bad television for a while now. Let's hack into the aircraft, and actually, I think the new television show Scorpion or whatever it is was some guys hacked into the airplanes and they were flying all over the place and they needed to unhack it. So unfortunately, CEOs and CFOs don't really ever think out of the box. They think about the day-to-day running. They don't. So they should hire somebody like Rob Mark to think of this stuff.
Well, I think that's a problem with many industries in the U.S. is that we are way too day-to-day focused. I mean, I remember 25 years ago, they used to laugh at the Japanese for talking about taking a long time. Look at how long the Honda Jet has been in the certification process. And they just keep plugging along. They're perfectly happy if it takes an extra 3 or 4 or 5 years because they're in it for the long term. But we don't work like that over here anymore.
Yeah, and things are going to start to get dangerous because they're talking about it in the airlines is, you know, making use of some of the capabilities of satellite connections that provide in-flight internet and using those same networks for operational data. Others say that, well, no, you need an air gap between them, right? You need separate networks so that don't cross over, so that the operational data is isolated from the passenger stuff. But then some complain that that's too expensive, and can we really afford to do that?
Everything is too expensive.
Well, that's
everything
true.
Is too expensive. Like the monitoring of aircraft locations, everything is too expensive until you lose an airplane, like the Malaysian airline folks did last spring.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they don't care about the cost anymore. Now it's, how could you possibly have been so stupid? So it's, just to make David's point, though, I love the idea, David. And so folks, they can find my email at the end of the show in case anybody does need some communications consulting. And David, of course, will help me out with that. And
does David get a commission?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Okay. Hey, our next story. This comes from the AOPA Opinion Leaders blog. A number of folks write for that. This is from Ron Rapp, who was our guest back in episode 301. This is titled Liability, the Price We Pay. Now, Ron is talking about the fact that GA parts can be very expensive, and GA aircraft can be very expensive too, and product liability costs like insurance, like the costs of litigation for suits, these things can contribute significantly to the high prices that we that we see.
Well, but at least they're making the airplanes. I mean, they stopped making, Cessna stopped making single engine airplanes in, oh my, I should know this date, but
it's in the 80s. Probably,
yeah, late 80s maybe.
Yeah, 1986 or 7.
And they stopped, I think, for six or seven years.
Yeah, until the 90s.
And it was just because of this product liability issue. And it was only because they came up with a solution. And I don't know how that would affect the parts. Did that have a really tough did you guys take a pretty tough hit there on the parts side, Rachel? Or maybe you don't remember then. I don't know.
Let's see. My dad had an FBO and a repair station, and honestly, they never were working on brand new airplanes. It was still, they were still working on 60s, 70s, and with Cessna stopped making, 182s, 172s and stuff, it really didn't affect him that much. He still was working on twins and maintaining that stuff.
Hmm. Well, with a high new part prices, I would, and we're going to get into this coming up soon in more detail.
Don't even get me started.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, that makes, I would imagine, used parts, surplus parts, attractive because it's a lower cost option for people who need parts, right?
Yes and no. A lot of the larger salvage companies that I call them the monopoly men, and they half the price. So say something is $17,000. You know, they half it and then they take a little bit off and they're like, oh, this is how much it is. When really, I mean, look at 150 and 152 parts. You can buy a flying 150 for $15,000. You're not going to spend $8,000 on a horizontal. It's just not in the cards. So I honestly feel that a lot of these larger salvage companies they're still not pricing them right. It's not making it affordable. It's still a joke.
Interesting. So it's not so much market-based pricing is...
There are still parts that you can buy from the manufacturer that are not as expensive. It's easier, I feel, to purchase items used because a lot of times, a lot of people are... The parts are just as good. You don't have to buy new for something to still be functional.
Yeah, sure.
That's right. And that's why some people don't mind marrying people that have been previously married because they know what they're,
they know that you're already a basket case. So they know what they have on their way in. They know they own a 150. They know they own the 150. It's not going to be a 210, but they're going to be able to still fly.
That's precisely right. Boy, she's going to be a good guest.
I can tell. All right. Hey, let's talk military for just a second here. We have an article. This is from RP Defense blog. The S-97 Raider high-speed attack helicopter debuted. Now, this is from Sikorsky. They unveiled the prototype, the S-97 high-speed attack helicopter. This thing has a coaxial rotor and a rear-mounted propeller. So it has a top speed of 253 miles per hour, which, David, that's a lot faster than what we see currently from attack helicopters, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's a compound helicopter. It's the coaxial rotors eliminated tail rotor. So what they did was they point the tail rotor backwards so it provides thrust like a pusher propeller. The Raider is supposed to fit a class of helicopter. Now, if we go back to 2012, I interviewed the Sikorsky pilots of the X-2, which is where this aircraft came from. And then in 2013 at Oshkosh, we talked about the Raider prototype, and it's changed since then. It's designed to sort of replace the UH-60 and the OH-58 as a scout attack aircraft, as well as a transport aircraft. And basically, the future is speed and mobility, which helicopters are always at minimum have issues. And while the V-22 is successful, this is another way to approach the being able to ingress and egress quickly with the vertical takeoff and landing of capability of a helicopter. So the Army is looking for a new armed aerial scout, the AAS, and this is going to be one candidate for that.
This sort of strikes me as something that represents an inflection point as far as military helicopters go. This is a significant jump forward, it seems.
If it goes into production, you know, we had, if you go back in time, there was, we've had some other helicopters that were very advanced, but we ended up getting things like, we're still flying OH-58Ds instead of another Sikorsky project, which was a stealth helicopter that cost overruns and budgets and such. Sikorsky's already put a lot of money into this, and the end of the run is coming for most helicopters, the production run. So there has to be something new and different. So yeah, this is a quantum leap, but we'll see if quantum leaps can go into production.
Yeah, I guess that's always a question, because this is Sikorsky has not built this in response to an RFP or something from the military, right? This is sort of an internal.
No, there is an RFP out there. Sikorsky has been trying to get ahead of the curve, though. They'd like, before the Army officially comes out with the RFP, they'd like to be ahead of the curve and say, here, build your RFP around this. This is everything you want, and we'll see. It'll be interesting to see where this shakes out.
All right. On a sort of a sad note, we lost another important aviator. This is Jerry Mock, who was the first woman to fly solo around the world. She was 88. She flew a Cessna 180 that she flew around the world. Is that right, David?
Yes, and believe it or not, it hangs at our favorite museum.
Yes.
Udvar-Hazy of the Smithsonian. The aircraft was called the Spirit of Columbus, and she did fly around the world. Interestingly enough, she had never flown across oceans before before she did this. Mm. Likewise, the article does point out that on the around-the-world flight, she achieved her first instrument landing. So it's interesting the skill set that she took off with before she did this around the world flight.
All right.
Yeah, so I thought it was a very, I'm sorry.
No, you go.
I was going to say, I thought it was a very interesting story when I read about, she was not a glory hound in any way, shape, or form. In fact, she shunned the media light. So I often wondered what it would be like if somebody like her, if she would try something like that, if we had the kind of media then that we have now. And in fact, I think she kind of went off and became a bit of a hermit, didn't she, David?
Yeah, she really didn't want to. She did it. It was done. And then that's all she. She did go fly between 65 and 69. She did set more records and was in a fighter jet that for more than 1,000 miles an hour. But she'd rather wanted to, as she said, I'd rather go to an island where there are no phones or TVs and never talk to anyone again. So, yeah, a bit of a hermit. But, you know, there are people who are eccentric in the world who do amazing things and just disappear. You know, she did it. It was done. Time to live the rest of her life.
All right. One last thing before we talk with Rachel at Addison Airport. Rob, what's the news from Addison?
They have an EMAS. This is just a real quickie I had to tell everybody about. EMAS is that engineered material arresting system. It's a bunch of blocks they put at the end of the runway so that an airplane will not run off the runway and through the fence and hit buildings or cars or anything like that. And it'll stop an airplane from, I think, 70 or 80 knots in 500 feet. So that's pretty neat. But anyway, Addison did a really the what?
That sounds like it's going to hurt.
Well, yeah, I guess maybe when you think of it, the fact that you think you're probably going to die because you're going to go through the fence, maybe it's something you live with. I don't know, but they did a fun little thing when they built the EMAS down at Addison, and they put a time lapse camera, one of the GoPros, on there, and the guy went out every day and changed the card in the GoPro, and so you can see the entire EMAS, which took about 6 weeks to build, in 5 minutes, and it's kind of cool. I thought it was cool, but hey, what can I say? I don't get out very much, so they can go to AddisonAirport.net, and it's right on the front page of the website.
It's cool.
All right, yeah, sounds great. Thanks, Rob. All right, again, we're speaking with Rachel Payne. Rachel, maybe we can start off talking about sort of the salvage business, and where did you find aircraft to salvage?
That's always the first question everyone asks.
I was predictable, huh?
No, just a little bit. But honestly, you can find them anywhere. I mean, you don't even have to go to the airport. We go to some auctions and stuff like that, and I don't just get airplanes. People will call us and, you know, say they got parts that they want to sell. And a lot of it's word of mouth. And, you know, Billy Bob knows John over here. And, you know, they just all call me. And or I go lurking around the airports. And so, I mean, I guess like a blonde girl walking up asking about an airplane, you know, you're probably going to talk to her.
So are there some particular types or models that you're more attracted to that represent better opportunities for you, or are you just looking for anything?
I mean, if it's got flat tires and looks a little sad, it pretty much has my name on it. But we first started Fast Aviation with Beechcraft. So we specialize in early Bonanzas and Barons and Travelers and the old V-tails. So I don't know what it is about Bonanzas, but I just find Bonanzas. David comes across them. We really have just we have a lot of customers that are Bonanza flyers. So we really just try to stick with getting them. But now we're really venturing out, and we do a lot of single engine Cessnas and got twins. And I really don't go into turboprops or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And you've been flying for a long time, so you know what you're looking at.
Actually, yeah. I honestly just got my license a couple years ago, but I've been flying around since I was a baby. And my dad forced me. Well, I won't even say forced. He paid me hourly when I was really young. I think I was like 6 or 7 to sort microfish. And it's funny because I use that microfish today, like the actual whole library. And I know it's old school, but it's a great way to look everything up. And I found all these packages that have like my name written on it, like sorted by Rachel, and like it's all spelled all backwards. And that's how I learned, is going there and being at the airport. And a lot of my dad's friends used to call me the hangar brat. And I guess I just graduated a little, you know, post diaper. But
and so when you acquire an aircraft, what happens next? Who you disassemble it or leave it whole and just cannibalize parts? How do you handle that?
Ugh, I don't even like the word cannibalize.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
A big part of what we do is we're in the business for saving airplanes. And if we find an airplane that has just been sitting there for a long time, we really try to assess it as it can be a future project for someone. Or like maybe there's a program, like we have a program at a school just south of us that they're building RVs, and these kids build them in high school, and then when they graduate, they get to learn how to fly in them. So I try to find airplanes that I can turn into projects and hopefully keep it flying. And if not, if the airplane's too far gone with corrosion and such, we do part it out, and in theory, it keeps other airplanes flying. So we're just trying to keep everyone going.
How does the documentation work? How does the paperwork trail? How is that managed in situations like this?
We're not as strict with salvage companies and smaller GA. A lot of airplanes, you can give a COC, so you have to a certificate of conformity. So my AMP will pull something off of an airplane, and we have to know the serial number and the end number that it came off of. So when they have some form of paper trail, that goes into the logbook when it's installed on their airplane. But not everything has to have paperwork. We also sell to schools, so they have to for sure have paperwork. A lot of them need 8130s. Hmm. We're not a repair station, so we if we obtain items that have 8130s, that's a really good thing. I'll send avionics out. We'll send other items out to get overhauled, and they do come back with 8130s. Cody, our mechanic, she usually goes through everything and inspects it fully. I mean, strips it straight up down to bare aluminum.
What's an 8130?
It's basically like its birth certificate, the parts birth certificate. It gives it traceability, and it's, you know, FAA approved.
Yeah, I remember 8130s, Rob, from the commercial world when I was in that business. And that's the document that proves its flight worthiness.
Legitimate. Yeah, it's a legitimate aircraft part. Yeah, you didn't get it from Ace Hardware.
Right. And so if for example, well, when you buy a new part from the OEM, that'll, at least commercially, it'll come with an 8130. If, yes. Let's say, a part is removed or obtained and to be made serviceable needs to be overhauled or repaired to the manual, then the facility performing that repair will issue the 8130.
You're right. Or a 337. Yeah.
Or a 337. Yeah. So, and I imagine, Rachel, it's the same for GA as it is with commercial. Is if you have a part and you've got no paperwork, no 8130 or the equivalent, then it's scrap essentially.
Not necessarily. Not the FAA doesn't require that you have every single part have like an 8130 or something that traces it back. I mean, you can still install certain parts without having any traceability.
Right. So, it's part specific.
Yeah. Like if that airplane originally came with that exact part, and it's got it has to have like a data tag, like especially avionics. If it doesn't have a data tag, then it's scrap. So, which I never scrap. So that we don't do that.
Does the GA side of the parts business face some of the same problems that the airliner side does with all the bogus parts coming from who knows where around the world, or are people like you guys that take these airplanes apart one of the reasons it doesn't happen?
It doesn't really happen.
That's
like
two questions.
Yeah, it doesn't really happen like that. I mean, pretty much everything you get usually has a part number. Piper's really good at it. Beechcraft's really good at it, so you can pretty much, you know, trace it back. There's a lot of things that, like if it's an STC, like, you know, say your spinner is a fiberglass or a composite spinner, you're going to know that this did not come from the factory like that. I mean, some Piper Cherokees and stuff did, but you pretty much, if you have to have an STC, you can purchase the part, but then you have to go back to that manufacturer and go pay like $1,500 or whatever it is for an STC. They're not as, I really haven't seen a lot of, I guess that, I don't want to say it's counterfeit, or, I mean, what do you say that is? I haven't really seen that.
Yeah, you don't find that too often, but yeah, Rob, occasionally you run across a situation where someone has a part and has some paperwork, and there's something that's not fully legitimate in that whole chain.
Oh, I bet there's tons of people out there running parts that were not approved and stuff, but you know, it always rains on you when, you know, you see the FAA walking up to your airplane asking for your logbooks or such. So,
yeah, but why would anybody take the risk of buying a part? I mean, anybody that flies airplanes has got to know that there are some unscrupulous people out there in the industry. But why would you take a risk and buy, I don't know, let's say landing gear.
They use like a O-ring from the bookstore instead of.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, I've seen that. People do it. There's two types of people. There's the first type that they're either, I don't want to say that they're too cheap. I don't want to like pinpoint, you know, that type of person, but they really don't want to go spend that extra money when, you know, they're like, oh, well, I can go get it here and it's going to be no big deal. And then there are people that don't know. They truly don't know. And that's, I don't know, a lot with experimentals and light sports and sports and stuff. But that's a whole different ball game.
Interesting. So, yeah, so there's some awareness that people that own aircraft need to have when it comes to maintaining them with good, proper parts.
you can't just pull over on the side of the road. Like, yeah. You know, it's not like a car. The one thing my father always instilled in me is, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it right. And with aviation, you don't cut corners, you know. And my dad always said, you know, my baby girl might be flying this airplane one day. You know, I mean, yeah. That's really, truly, you got to think of it as if your child or your wife or whoever, your best friend, your mom is going to be flying that airplane.
So, right, that puts an obligation on you that should be sufficient motivation right there.
Yeah, that's how I feel when I sell any of my parts. I don't want to sell anything that's potentially could hurt someone. I mean, it's up to your mechanic to deem it airworthy, but you don't need to buy something that's not going to work for you.
Hmm. Now, you created something called Hangar Swap. Can you tell us about that?
Hangar Swap is something, it's totally new, and it's because we were desperate. And it's a website for, it's like eBay and Amazon and like that whole aspect into one website.
So this is a place where people can list parts they have to sell
as well as buy and sell. And it's on a, instead of like a commission based system, it's just a monthly membership. If you can remember back to the day where like old school aviation, where everyone hung out at the airport. And I mean, that's what we did all the time. We hung out at the airport. My dad would, you know, somebody's got parts in their hangar and, you know, you go over and, hey, how much you want for that? You know, oh, buy me lunch. You know, it's like, I want it to be like that, but virtual. So people can truly find the airplane parts that they need without searching too far. You could theoretically be sitting here in your pajamas buying airplane parts.
Yeah. And so how long has Hangar Swap been up? Not too long?
We're going on our second month.
Oh, okay. So this is fairly new.
Yeah, no, it seriously just happened. We built it in 2 weeks.
And so how's the response been so far? Is it? I imagine this is something that would sort of grow slowly as more and more people became aware of it.
Yes. We actually, I'm really surprised at how many customers and members that we have online already. We have a little over 70. And I mean, just for starting something from nothing, literally from nothing, and we had no idea what we were doing. It basically, you know, we ended up not being on eBay anymore. And you know what they say about a scorned woman, just don't get in front of her. I mean, it was do or die. I wasn't going to let eBay ruin us. And I mean, it was really depressing. It was really sad there for a couple weeks, just trying to figure it out. And Dwayne, our IT guy, who we originally hired to work with our inventory, he quit his job Friday, started Monday. We got kicked off of eBay on Tuesday, and we were like, holy crap. And then he's like, hey, I know how to code, and I used to do websites like way back in the day. I'm like, what? So here's me and Dwayne, like, night and day, I mean, building this website, and we're all writing things down. David, we're all sitting around, everyone at Fast Aviation, and we're throwing ideas out there. And it's so cool how it's just turned into something that, I mean, it was in my brain, and now it's on my computer screen.
Yeah, it sounds all very entrepreneurial. This is in addition to the business that you run otherwise, right? This is not the whole business.
No, I mean, we just got back from a whole transport. We hauled we haul like vehicles and airplanes, and we went up to Michigan and dropped off a truck and picked up a Russian experimental.
Yeah, what was that? Tell us about that.
It's a Kappa Sova, and it's really rare, and I can't find anything about it. And the only thing I find on the internet is all in Russian, and I barely can speak German. So I had no idea what it was. Me and David were like, oh my gosh, it could take us like 2 days straight tearing this thing down. We had no idea if it was going to be different hardware or whatnot. I mean, we brought everything with us. So we get there, we tear it all down. It was the fastest teardown ever. It was ridiculous. It was like we were gone by lunchtime. So, and what's crazy, it's painted in American flag colors. It's awesome.
So what kind of an airplane is it? I mean, is it a
It's just an experimental, and it's called a Kappa Sova. And honestly, I try to research more information about it. It's got a Rotex in it. It's just like, it's a retractable, and it's a little two-seater. And I mean, it really looks like it'll just boot, scoot, and boogie. Hmm. So,
well, maybe some of our listeners will be familiar with that. David, is this anything you've ever heard of? Maybe too obscure, huh?
Yeah, this one's going to be a bit of a challenge for me. First of all, you're never sure how to spell it.
Yeah.
It's written on the tail. I mean, and the thing is, hopefully we got this not, manual.
Hopefully not in Cyrillic.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's straight up. I mean, it looks like an American plane. And then you get the manual and it's on Russian. You're like, holy crap, I'm going to pull this thing apart. It was just like a puzzle, taking a puzzle apart. It was crazy.
How did you find this?
This was with a client that we actually hauled another airplane for him the same time last year. And we're going to haul it down to Miami, and it's going to go in a container. It's going to go to Brazil, and it's going to go live its life in Brazil. Hmm.
So when you look ahead, I guess, into the future, probably a lot of what you think about is the new site. Anything that you see going on just in general with regards to the this industry, the serviceable parts industry?
Well, I can tell you right now, flying is not going to become any cheaper. I mean, it's, you know, $5, $6 a gallon for avgas. So, you know, avgas isn't going to get cheaper, like, exponentially. So you have to be able to affordably keep up, you know, with your airplane. So I really hope that the larger salvage companies really get on the bandwagon of trying to become more affordable. You know, you call and they want like $6,000 for a cowling, and it's like you about to have a heart attack. I just don't see it being that expensive. Like, when I look at something, I'm just like, really? This can't be that expensive. You know, and I still try to keep up with everyone because, you know, I don't want it to be too cheap and then these items aren't as valuable. You know, to the aircraft owners. So I really hope that it becomes a little more affordable. I really don't want to see aviation dying. I mean, a lot of people are going to light sport, especially with, like, the whole medical issues. And, I mean, I have a special issuance. It's the hardest thing to get a medical. I have to get my medical going, like, 3 months ahead, like, before January. So it's a pain in the butt. So, I mean, if we want to keep this going, there's got to be something that's got to give.
Yeah. What's your heart surgery story?
Hereditary or something?
Actually, yeah, my grandpa died really young, I guess 64, because of heart failure, and his mitral valve was bad. But no one knew that I had a heart issue until I was 18, and I rode dirt bikes, I did ballet, I was super active, you know, always doing stuff, always at the airport. I wanted to get my pilot's license, and I just started feeling really crappy, and my normal doctor wasn't there, and I saw the practitioner, and he was like, oh my gosh, your heart rate's 135 resting, and freaking out. And then over the next course of the year, I did all these tests, and it just got worse and worse. I couldn't even walk up the stairs. I slept all the time. I couldn't do anything. It was really bad. And all of a sudden, I went and took another test, and they're like, holy crap, your mitral valve isn't even pumping blood into your upper ventricles.
Wow.
So I ended up having emergency surgery that following week on just that Monday, and I had minimal invasive surgery, so I didn't have a zipper, but I had that surgery, and I did a 5K 3 weeks afterwards when I couldn't even walk up the stairs 3 weeks, you know, 4 or 5 weeks prior to that. Hmm. So, and then I was able to get closer to getting my license, but I ended up having another surgery to fix the electrical issues. And I had complications from it, and I had 3 blood clots that stopped in my lungs. I'm missing part of my lung, and I somehow didn't stroke out or anything. And I mean, I was in the hospital for 10 days, you know, a lot of medical bills. And if it wasn't for being able to sit on the computer and sell airplane parts off of eBay, I really don't know, you know, where we would have been. I mean, my parents paid so much money with all the testing, and finally I have a clean bill of health. I can get my medical every year. It's a special issuance, but I can fly airplanes, and that's what matters.
Wow. You're lucky to be alive.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you're going to go fly an airplane, who cares if it's old? As long as it's safe, go fly it. You could die tomorrow, seriously.
Wow. Yeah, good. Well said.
Yeah, that's pretty compelling. Yeah.
Holy smokes. You know, do you sell parts outside the United States, Rachel?
All the time. Canada's a big seller. Australia. I send a lot to Australia and Brazil. Brazil is hopping. I mean, they're all about Beechcraft. They're all about airplanes, flying, general aviation. I have a lot of Brazil customers that come, seriously, they come to the United States and they come to Orlando, they bring their families to Disney and stuff, and they come and hang out. And they come dig around the yard, and half of them are speaking in Portuguese, and I have no idea what they're saying, but they still have some form of English that they can speak, and it's so cool meeting someone that's into the same thing you are, but in a totally different world.
Yeah, fascinating.
Are you going to tell us about this obsessive compulsive disorder that seemed to have coined, Rachel?
Did you see the video?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a video. I was laying in bed, and David was next to me snoring.
David's your husband, by the way, right?
Yeah, okay. David's my husband, yeah.
Good thing, and I was just going to ask that.
Want to be clear.
Yeah. Wanted to make sure.
And my fat little wiener dog was leaning up against my leg, and I'm sitting there. I'm like, how can I get people to understand hangar swap? You know, what do I run into all the time? And it's these people that hoard airplane parts. And it's seriously, I swear to God, it's a disease. I'm not kidding. My grandpa had it. My dad has it. I have it now. It's really bad. It's there. It is real.
I love that. I'm looking at the video and I see this airplane on a stick. It looks like a biplane of some kind. Is that a weather vane?
Yeah. I don't know. It just hangs out, and my parents never put it on their roof, and I love it. And I think we found it at like one of those, oh my gosh, Harbor Freight. And you know, it's so heavy. It's like, you don't even want to move it. So I thought that would be perfect for my whole ending of hangar swap, which is, I honestly think that the ending of the OAPHCD video is the best part.
Wow. Well, I won't give it away.
No, if you haven't seen it, you have to watch it. I mean, I was seriously sitting there thinking about like all those things to say, and I was crying laughing. It took me like 5 takes just to say it.
All right. Rachel, tell our listeners where they can find more about you online.
Well, we are on pretty much every single social media out there. We have an Etsy shop that we are totally redoing. We're working with a bunch of artists. I have a really good friend of ours in North Carolina, Mike Dotson. He's got like a Pitt's lower wing that he's turning into furniture. And then I have a friend, Chad, with Lucky Tramp Customs. And he is amazing when it comes to paint. So he's going to be doing some really cool stuff with like propellers and aluminum. And it's the Recycled Flyers Club. We also have our Facebook pages, which is facebook.com/fastaviation and also /hangar swap. And we're on Twitter, so Fast Aviation Florida. And my name on there is the Aircraft Salvage Queen. You can't miss it. And then my dad used to call me the Aircraft Salvage Princess, but now that I'm like older and married and, you know, I don't
graduate
any more mature, but... but definitely I've graduated a little bit. And then of course the Twitter for Hangar Swap, and I'm on Instagram and all that stuff. So,
all right, good. And we'll put links to all those in the show notes. So, you can find them there if that's easier. All right, good. So Rachel, it's been fantastic. Interesting conversation. Want to thank you for spending a few minutes with us. Are you able to hang out with us for more of the show?
Oh yeah. I'll be here for the duration.
Okay. Very good. All right, and now here's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association to tell us what to expect in the next NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Howdy, geeks. This week, we wrap up our look at the NBAA Safety Committee's top 10 focus areas with a special segment on single-pilot safety. What are the issues, and what are the tools you can bring to bear? Check it out on the upcoming edition of NBAA's Flight Plan. As always, you'll find us on the web at NBAA.org.
Thanks, Pete. And now here's David Vanderhoof. David, tell us about what you've been doing lately.
Well, this is sort of a follow-on to last week talking about going down to Oceania. So I'll just take it from there. I like air shows. I like them, but I get tired and static displays are often static. The NES Oceania air show became a 4-day air show. I flew on Thursday. Friday was the media day. Saturday morning, we woke up to what was
not going to be a good weather day. So on the way down on Thursday, I put the thought in my friend Dave's mind that maybe we should take a side trip during the weekend. We took that trip. We went south. It was raining in Virginia Beach, but it was just overcast in North Carolina. Kill Devil Hills, North Carolina, to be exact. I went to where it first happened. First is in air quotes for those naysayers, Grant and Max. I have now completed the triumvirate. I've seen the Dayton Bicycle Shop where the dream began. I've seen the fulfillment of the dream at the Smithsonian on the Mall, and I needed to see where it happened. I can now say I have. The Wright Brothers National Memorial is in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Kitty Hawk is part of the Outer Banks, a line of barrier islands 200 miles long that run the length of the state of North Carolina. In 1903, there wasn't much there except wind and sand. So fast forward to 111 years in the future, what's there now? You arrive into a welcome center. There's a small museum and a book/gift shop. As you walk through, you see how the two brothers moved from bicycle builders to aircraft builders. The visitor center does a good job of driving home that this was not an overnight process. Trial and error starting in 1900. The center houses a reproduction of the 1902 glider, and the centerpiece is a replica of the 1903 flyer. The visitor center also houses the Paul E. Garber First Flight Shrine. The shrine, quote, honors those individuals and groups who have achieved significant firsts in aviation development, unquote. A new inductee is introduced on December 17th of each year. Interestingly enough, Airplane Geeks is quite fond of the 2012 recipient, Charles Frank Bolden Jr., otherwise known as Charlie Bolden, the director of NASA. Other people have included William Boeing, Dr. Richard Whitcomb, the inventor of area rule, and others like Anne Baumgardner, who was the first WASP. As you leave the visitor center, you walk out along a path to two small huts, reconstructed in their original places. One is the living quarters. You can see their bunks in the kitchen and properly set dinner table. Looking at it, my mind drifted off to the dinner conversation, a discussion of the day's experiments and solutions for tomorrow. It clearly is a home. Next to it is the hangar for the 1903 flyer. The flyer slid in sideways. The hut made it so they could work on the fragile piece of linen and metal as the winds blew outside. Beyond that is a stone, a large piece of granite. Next to the stone is a long strip of metal, the launch rail. The stone is the point of liftoff of the first flight, where the 1903 flyer left the rail and began to soar. As you look to your right, you will see four stones of increasing height, a hinge to one of man's greatest achievements, the first floor controlled powered flights of two men that occurred on December 17th, 1903. The first marker you come to is the end of the first flight, a whole 12 seconds for 120 feet. The pilot was Orville. The second marker is slightly taller than the first and a little further down. Wilbur, who lost the coin toss, was the second pilot. Again, it was only 12 seconds, but this time he showed his brother how to do it by going an additional 55 feet for a total of 175 feet. Orville then took the third flight, 15 seconds and 200 feet. Lastly, you then walk for what seems to be a quantum leap to the fourth marker, the final flight of the day in the 1903 flyer. Wilbur flew it, 59 seconds and a total of 852 feet, before having a hard landing and breaking the rudder. The aircraft after that never flew again. Standing at that point, you look back to see how far we've come. As you look back the flat plain, you'll see Kill Devil Hill, the home of the monument. As you climb the hill that the Wrights so often flew off of, at the top is an airfoil-shaped wing ordered by Congress to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the first flight. From the top, you look out to the Atlantic Ocean and inland to the bays, and you can also see KFFA, or First Flight Airport. Yes, you can fly to this national park, and it's still on my bucket list that I haven't done that yet. The 3,000-foot runway is 220 and a whopping 13 feet above sea level. Also, you can look down on the sculpture garden of the flyer taking off, getting its picture taken. You can actually climb on the sculpture and see what Orville saw. So my thoughts? I cried. It was humbling. It was the perfect day to go. The wind had a chill, the skies were gray, and you do feel there are ghosts in the air. I had to go. I had to see, to feel, to taste, to smell. I had to walk that 120 feet, understanding the dream of two brothers who were not going to stop until that dream was reality. My advice is, if you get the chance, you must go. So that's David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Quite a trip, kind of a pilgrimage sort of a trip.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's always been on the bucket list, and, you know, and for I and my friend Dave, and I absolutely don't regret we did it, you know, and if you get the chance, fly in. Of course, that would be the ultimate way to arrive, but if you love aviation and you have the ability to go there, going there means going there. It's not something that you, unless you're going to Outer Banks for vacation, it's not something you can make a real side trip to. So I recommend it highly.
All right. Yeah, I've never been there. Rob or Rachel, have either of you guys been to that site?
No, I never have.
I believe I went there when I was really little, and I don't remember.
Too young to remember, huh? So
yeah. I can't remember yesterday, so I don't know.
Oh, you're too young to be so forgetful.
You're right.
All right, good. So, David, you've got to take off now, I understand, and meet our Australian friend at the airport. Is that right?
Absolutely. So I got to go pick an Aussie up at Philadelphia International Airport and take him out for a cheesesteak. So,
all right. Say hello from all of us.
I will. And thanks, everybody.
All right. Thanks, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, October 7th, 2014. G'day folks, and welcome to the AusDesk for episode 319 of the Airplane Geeks. And today it's just me here in the studio. I was going to try and record with ATC Ben, but my weekend went kind of crazy. I had a friend from Argentina visiting, and it's been pretty flat out. And it's now Tuesday morning our time, and I'm recording this just in time to send it to Max, I hope. But anyhow, first bit on the news is actually from back in New Zealand, where I was the other week. And this is the Martin Aircraft Company. They're the folks who are developing the Martin Jetpack. Not really a jetpack. It's actually a rather large ducted fan system that gets strapped to your back. It was shown over in Oshkosh many years ago, and a lot of people weren't really impressed with it. Part of that problem was because the guys couldn't really fly it due to restrictions and crowd controls and so on. They had to keep it tethered. They weren't really allowed to do much. And I remember the guys from Martin being a little upset that they weren't able to really show off the jetpack at Oshkosh, which led to a lot of people thinking it's probably not that great. Well, the Martin jetpack has been developed in the meantime, and it's looking pretty good. They've done a lot of the research and development, and they're now getting ready to commercialize it, and they're actually going to take the Martin Aircraft Company public. They're going to try to raise $25 million in an initial public offering. They're going to see what they can get up to. The jetpack's pretty cool, designed to be flown by a pilot strapped into it or via remote control. They claim that it's great for use in emergency situations that helicopters can't get into. It is pretty impressive to see it going and see a person flying around. They were also working on a ballistic recovery systems parachute for the unit as well, because of course, if the engine gives out, you're coming down pretty hard and you don't have a seat to try and absorb all the impacts. So parachute is a good idea, but they think the IPO should be a bit of a success and will give them a market cap of about $122 million. So the idea is to start making up to 500 jetpacks annually in New Zealand within a couple of years. Then they want to expand to overseas manufacturing. They've got interest from all around the world. This could be an amazing thing for them. Meanwhile, back here closer to home, the Civil Aviation Safety Authority is copping some flack for their introduction of Part 61 licensing. They did try and introduce it earlier in the year, but it got put on hold and was pushed back to 1 September. They then pushed through despite people in the industry still saying there was problems, and Part 61 is now live. And this gives us a whole new method of licensing. The basic core concepts are still the same, and they've introduced a new recreational pilot's license, which is a bit of a blast from the past, because the RPL was something they introduced a while back and then just buried because it didn't really work. They've done it slightly differently this time, and it's more like a little RAOS license for GA aircraft. They've introduced the Manual of Standards concept, which tells you how to do things and so on, and there's been a lot of issues found, according to some, related to how that Manual of Standards talks about the kind of training required. A few of the issues that have come up have related to tailwheel endorsements and training and performance management. management for climbouts and landings and tailwheels. And I know a couple of tailwheel instructors who have read the information and said they really want to see a CASA-approved examiner demonstrate it for them, because they're pretty sure it'd trash the aircraft if they tried. So it's kind of interesting, and we'll see where all that goes. CASA's saying that it's not introducing any new costs, not costing anyone anything to get their licenses transitioned. And while that is technically correct, that people are getting their new Part 61 licenses sent out with whatever endorsements they currently have, there are additional costs to be incurred for those who want to add new endorsements, particularly in aerobatics and tailwheel and so on. To keep some ratings, you've got to do more. You have to do more flight tests and checks and so on. So costs are likely to go up with this. There are a few flight schools that are scratching their heads about it. And a lot of it seems to be the famous devils in the details issues. So hopefully they can get this all sorted out. CASA is engaging on further education and assistance for the transition. But I think some of these things will just have to be argued out at the higher levels. And speaking of the higher levels, Australia has confirmed it's going to get two extra C-17s. That will take our total fleet up to 8. And they're also considering an additional 2, which could take us up to 10. Now, I know that's nothing compared to the US, but for us here in Australia, that's pretty amazing, especially as we're all scratching our heads wondering where they're going to put them. Because if all 6 of the C-17s and all 5 KC-30s were to park at Amberley, there wouldn't be a lot of space left. And Amberley Air Base near Brisbane there also has the Growlers and the Super Hornets. So it's becoming quite a packed base, especially with the additional 2 C-17s. And then the indications are that the C-27J Spartans we're getting will be based at Amberley eventually. They'll start off in Richmond as a temporary measure and then transition up to Amberley. So Amberley is going to get very crowded. I suspect we're going to be seeing a lot of aircraft deployed into forward areas, much as the E7 Wedgetail is currently officially based at Williamtown, but quite often seen deployed at forward bases at Tyndall and so on. There is some thought that the same may wind up happening for the C-27J. So although the RAAF are doing improvements to Amberley and expanding the areas, it's very likely that a number of these aircraft from both the KC-30A, the C-17 and the C-27J will be scattered around Australia and the world on foreign deployments, local deployments, missions and so on. But if all those aircraft did come back, I think it would be a lot like the aircraft groundings of September 11. Where do we put them all? The other bit of news to end on is that both of the RAAF's first F-35s, known as AU-1 and AU-2, officially the RAF serials A-35-001 and -002, have flown. The first one made its flight at the end of September, and the second one on October 1st. So now both of our initial F-35 airframes have flown, and once they go through the trial assessments and so on, they'll be ferried over to Luke Air Force Base next year, and our official training program will kick into higher gear with our own aircraft. That's all for me. I've managed to get this one out in time. Yay! Yeah, definitely missing Steve and his elite editing skills, but we'll see how we go with this one. Thanks, folks, and we'll catch you next week.
All right, now here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
I'm joined by Mick Oakey from the Aviation Historian. Mick, welcome back across the pond.
Thanks very much, Peter.
Now, Mick, the last time we talked was at the Farnborough Air Show. I saw you working very hard. Lots of people coming up to see you to talk about the magazine. Very busy, but it hasn't stopped there, has it? Since then, you've literally not come off the road.
That's absolutely right. The summer has been absolutely manic. After the week at Farnborough, we were straight into preparing more work on the magazine. But then I was off at the Woburn Abbey Javelin Moth Club International yep. Rally for a whole weekend.
That looked quite amazing, actually.
It was a terrific event. We went there. This was our second year at the Moth Rally, and it was just a wonderful event, lovely atmosphere, sort of garden party atmosphere, lots yeah. of activity, lots of moths flying in and out. One of the highlights of the show was supposed to be the two Lancasters, and they couldn't quite make it. Because that was when the Canadian one blew an engine, and it was like, oh, what a shame. But it didn't spoil the event. It was still an absolutely fantastic weekend.
And you've also done some speaking events as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I've done a couple of things. One which is slightly off the wall at Linfield Arts Festival in Sussex. I was invited to go and do a reading, so I did a preview of a brilliant story we've got coming up in TAH. And then I also did a talk at Shoreham Airport Society about a couple of weeks ago, which was about my sort of 30 years as an aviation history journalist. And that went down quite well, I'm pleased to say.
Sadly missed out on that. Maybe next time I should come along with my recorder. Maybe we should do something like that. But let's talk about the next issue of the magazine, eagerly awaited. As I've said before, I've really enjoyed the difference that you've brought to the sector with the content and the material that you've got in the magazine. What have we got coming up in the latest edition?
Well, the new edition, which is out on October the 15th, we've got some fantastic stories. The one I mentioned a moment ago that I did the reading of at Linfield is by a chap, Geoffrey Watson, who was a newspaper journalist who in 1967 was fortunate to have a ride in an English Electric Lightning. And it was just as Concorde was sort of coming into the public consciousness, if you like. And the angle was, in a little while, the public are going to be flying at Mach 2 sipping champagne. In the meantime, what's it like to fly supersonic? And Geoffrey had this ride, and he wrote it up at the time, but he's written it up again now all these years on for us. And it's just a wonderful piece of writing. Very, very lively, very amusing. For instance, he sort of describes it. He says, flying in a Lightning, it's like a Jaguar D-Type on steroids. It's like the Rolling Stones in surround sound after 8 gallons of LSD, which is, you know, fairly memorable. And he talks about how the supersonic, when you're in a supersonic climb in a Lightning, if your teeth aren't in good fettle, the chances are your fillings will pop out. And that indeed happened to him. And he describes all this. Yes, really. And it was quite a problem at the time. When he went along to have his medical before the flight, the doctor sort of did all the tests and that was fine. Then he had to go and see the dentist. And the dentist said, I don't like the look of your teeth. We're going to do you several new fillings right now. So he had to succumb to that. But even then, when he was actually on the flight, several of his fillings parted company as they were halfway up the climb.
Whole new meaning to losing your teeth, I suppose.
Absolutely. And it's just because of the rapid change of air pressure. If there's a tiny little pocket of air, you know, embedded under the filling in your tooth, that's going to expand and pop the thing out. It could actually sometimes have very, very serious consequences.
Gosh, I didn't know that. I learned something new every time on this show.
Absolutely.
So what else is in the next edition?
We've got a very interesting investigation into the loss of a Short Empire flying boat that was being operated by Qantas in 1942. It was doing an evacuation flight from Java to Broome in Australia, and it just disappeared without trace. And we've had that sort of fully investigated by a flying boat specialist, Phil Weber, and he's come up with the solution of what actually happened to it.
Do we have to wait for it to come out before we find that solution, or are there any hints along the way?
Well, it was shot down by the Japanese, which is not really a surprise, but we've actually got chapter and verse now because he was able to consult somebody who had the Japanese records at the time, and he was able to piece together the jigsaw from both the Japanese and the Australian angles. So, you know, that's a really sort of serious piece of research, which is great to have.
Excellent. Our Australian friends will be interested in that one, I think.
Yeah, I hope so. And another World War II thing we've got is about the United States, the US Army Air Corps' nutty plan in 1941 to create armoured fighters specifically to ram enemy bombers. They were going to turn P-39s and P-40s into what they called ram fighters by putting a load of extra armour around the cockpit and around the engine and instructing the pilots to just fly straight at a German bomber or Japanese bomber and ram it.
Right. Okay.
And then of course the idea was the pilot would then bail out.
Good luck.
Yeah, exactly. Luckily they never went through with it, and they kind of decided, well, actually, with all that armor, wouldn't we be better off to just not have the armor and have some heavy cannon instead and blow the thing out of the sky? But they really seriously considered this plan for a while. So we've got a fascinating article about, you know, all the discussions and the disagreements and the madcap ideas around that.
Another fascinating edition of the magazine to come out, Mick. Where can we find out about it online?
If you have a look on our website, which is www.theaviationhistorian.com, then that'll tell you all about it. Once the new issue is published, it'll have a contents page up for the issue and various preview spreads and so on. And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter.
Right, and with Christmas around the corner, what a fantastic opportunity for a little present for somebody to get an annual subscription. It's not overly expensive, so I'm certainly hoping that I get that in my stocking this year. Mick, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
So, Rob, have you ever heard of these Ram fighters before?
No. I thought that was really fascinating when I was listening to Peter talk. Of course, you know, Peter and that other fellow both have that accent, so it always makes everything sound much more interesting than we might be used to. So who knows? Maybe they're making all this up.
I don't know.
Just to entice us, because they know we can't be over there to see it. No, seriously, I thought that sounded pretty interesting. Actually, I'd like to. And I'm actually pretty interested in that magazine.
Yeah, my wife's been asking me what I want for Christmas, and maybe I've got an idea for her now.
I wonder if it's too bad David's not here. We could ask him about that.
Yes, yeah. So, and the other thing is, Fillings actually coming out. I think I'd heard of that before, but never thought that was really really possible. Rachel, have you ever done any fast flying? I'm sure nothing as fast as would cause your fillings to come out.
No, nothing that. I mean, for my birthday last year, I rolled a T6, but.
Oh, did you? And you rolled it?
Yeah, I got some friends over at the Kissimmee Warbird Adventures, and for my birthday, I got to go up and do some aerobatics. And Tom Richard, he flies the Mustang and the Reno Air Races, and he took me up on my birthday, and
wow.
He did rolls and everything. He showed me how to do it, and then I did it, and it was so cool watching the GoPro video. I'm like, biggest nerd ever, so happy, and I really want to do more of it. And it's crazy what they talk about with like the blacking out and stuff. I mean, you really have to use your core. I'm glad I did ballet for so long, so it really came in handy. It's my girly side.
So you were actually doing maneuvers where blacking out was a possibility?
Yeah. Yeah, if you didn't keep your head up and like your stomach, all your muscles engaged, it could totally happen. I mean, you could even start to gray out on some of the maneuvers he was doing.
Right.
And I didn't perform those because I have really low blood pressure. And so I just, that maneuver was not in the cards for me.
Wow. All right, well, let's move on to some listener mail. We heard from Murray. Now, Murray's an instrument-rated private pilot. He says he flies out of Cincinnati, mainly in Cirrus aircraft, and he's currently training for his commercial certificate, although he has no aspirations, no desire to fly for an airline. But he says he does love flying. And he wrote us about episode 317. He says, the Navion was new to me, and now I want to learn more about this fascinating airplane. A Navion with a turboprop built by Sierra Hotel would be wicked cool. But he goes on to talk about automation. And this is obviously something that we talk about a lot here. And he was referring to the robot we mentioned that has been designed to operate aircraft controls. And Murray says, as one of you said, it makes no sense to build a C-3PO to sit in the cockpit and hold the stick. It would be inefficient to introduce a source of mechanical failure, too expensive to retrofit old airplanes. And let me stress above this, above all else, he says, super stupid looking. He says, I keep imagining the inflatable captain from Airplane. Yeah, that's just an image.
Best movie ever.
Best movie ever. You just can't get that out of your head once it's once it's there. But he says, I would be comfortable with a digital pilot if it had been thoroughly tested. Why not? He says, a computer. Now, this is kind of an argument that I know some people have had, at least in their minds, but maybe haven't vocalized, maybe for fear of being slammed by the pilots in the audience. But he says, a computer would not forget how to set the auto throttle and crash a perfectly good airplane into the seawall short of the runway. He says a computer would have maneuvered around a storm, even if it lost airspeed data. It would not be forgotten that pitch plus power equals performance and stall an otherwise perfectly good airplane into the ocean. So he's got some other examples too, but yeah, you get the idea. It's that a large number, and I'll let Rob jump in because I know he's going to, a large number of aviation accidents end up being attributed to pilot error. And so there is an argument that says that if that was all automated, then, you know, that would eliminate pilot error. Okay,
and
Rob.
And
the fun. So, okay, now you guys are up.
Well, there's no doubt that pilot error is much more significant, but I think we should be absolutely clear here, especially because I'm sitting at an aviation safety event here in Wichita. It's not just pilot error; it's human factors that play into the I believe about 3/4 of most of the accidents that occur in these days, and it's a sad number, but. You know, we'd have to be certain that we weren't trading one problem for another, in the sense that, you know, he mentioned, you know, the Air France airplane. And, well, you know, I mean, they could, the guys that were up there could have flown it too if they had realized what the problem was. But without solid data being, you know, sent to the computers would have been as stupid as the pilots apparently were. There's no one answer for all of this, I don't think. But, and I won't say anything else about that letter from that there listener, even though I agreed with a lot of it, because he does fly Cirrus. So I just don't agree with everything.
Yeah, and that's fine. Yeah, Rachel, do you think we'll ever see a pilotless airliner? I mean, Murray says that, you know, maybe this would start out with maybe military, you know, freighters or commercial freighters, things like that. And maybe eventually we could get to the point where maybe a human on the ground, as Murray says, could babysit the computer. Do you think we'll ever see that or just fantasy?
I think it might be a good safety feature, but I mean, isn't that what we pay the pilots for? And, you know, they need to know how to operate that system. They go through extensive training on how to go through all that. So,
yeah, it's I don't know. I think that we'll see something like that, and possibly starting in the freight end of the business, but not anytime soon. I don't think. I think we're a long, long ways away from that, but we'll see. Kyle wrote in, we've mentioned this in the past. He says, every year during the first week of November, several teams flying full-scale flight simulators take part in a round-the-world flight for charity. And that's up again this year. He says, each team raises money for a different charity in their local country through their own individual websites. And Kyle is on Team USA, which is out of Sarasota, Florida. And there is a website where you can learn more about this. So this is called World Flight. You can visit worldflightgroup.com. And then the team website is Cockpit Builders World Flight Team USA, which is at worldflight.cockpitbuilders.com. And see, the charity for the U.S. team is the All Children's Hospital in St. Petersburg, Florida. So we'll have those links in the show notes, but that's something that you might want to take a look at and maybe support. Last time we talked about old historic aircraft and should you fly them or not. And we heard from a couple listeners, from Glenn. He says, just listening to the debate about whether or not old and rare aircraft should fly. I think Rachel's going to have something to say about this, too.
Do it. You only live once. You might as well. I mean, a lot of people did it before. So what's wrong with doing it now?
So he says, Glenn says, as some people say, it is a risk, but worth it, I think. He said he was at Dave Allen's collection near Seattle, was amazed how many aircraft he has, and they are all airworthy. The IL-2 was the star of the show and the only one flying in the world. Also, the long-nosed FW-190 was pretty special, but it didn't fly at the air show. And then we heard from Randy on that topic, too. Randy had an interesting perspective. It's kind of a long email, but basically he's saying that I think part of this debate stems from how one views an airplane as an artifact. He says, personally, I see historical aircraft as the accumulated knowledge of the engineering, construction, and operation from that aircraft's time period. He says, admittedly, I'm far less romantic in my view of history than many others who instead see something like the Spirit of St. Louis as a tangible link to the past, something of a metaphorical time machine. He says, if that is the role of an artifact, then it makes sense to keep it on the ground because there's no replacing that link once it's broken. But he says, the ground is not necessarily a guarantee of safety. Hangars get flooded, there's fires, and so on and so forth. But then he says, if, however, you hold the view that I do, that then much of the risk of flying these rare planes can be mitigated by documenting every aspect of that plane possible. He says, yes, it'll take time and money to do it, but once that information is preserved, there's no amount of damage that can occur to that artifact that will ruin its value to history. Think of it like an insurance policy. Photograph, measure, copy documents, make detailed drawings, even 3D scan if possible. He says, we live in the information age and easily can have the capacity to retain all of this in multiple secure locations. We can safely assume that guys like Paul Allen and Peter Johnson have the budget to do those sorts of things. So I think that was a really interesting kind of perspective. I guess whether you fly it or park it, in Randy's view, is sort of a function of how do you view the historical meaning of the aircraft. So, thanks to you two guys for sending in those thoughts. I think really good. Rachel's clearly in the fly it camp. And
if you've ever gone to Sun and Fun, and we go every single year, been going since I was a baby, you see the Ford Tri-Motor flying in and out all day long. They have biplane rides. They have people flying these older aircraft. And it's affordable, too. I mean, it's less than $100, I think, to go flying. And it right there, they do it all week long. It never stops flying. So it obviously is safe to fly.
Yeah, I think with enough maintenance, you can preserve maintenance and money. You can preserve almost every airplane in flying condition. The argument by those who say don't fly them is that, you know, if you're down to only a few, one or a few left, then if you crash it, or as David described last episode, turn it into a ball of metal, then you've lost the airplane for forever.
Well, we were over at Kermit Weeks, and we did a Fast Aviation field trip. We do them every once in a while, and I mean, they remake every single part, so it can be done to rebuild things. And what you're saying about maintenance, you know, if something has ADs or whatnot, you know, and it's complied with, and you know, the airplane is fully inspected and it's safe, I don't see a reason not to go flying. A lot of these airplanes were made better then than they are now.
Yeah, I guess I'm probably in the go ahead and fly it camp.
Me too.
Obviously, be very careful and make sure that it's operated safely. But
Safety first.
But yeah, I kind of like the fly it idea. All right, just a couple others quickly. Ryan wrote in, we were talking about seaplanes, float planes. This is Rob, after your adventure with Matt Desch.
Successful adventure.
So
yes.
Ryan sent in a couple of photos. He said, first one was a Grumman Goose, a GA-21 Goose. He said, no, this is a seaplane, but I have always called it a flying boat. And then he sent in a picture of a de Havilland Beaver and said, well, this is a float plane. So what do you do when you want to know about seaplanes, float planes, all that? Who do you call, Rob?
Call Google. Ghostbusters?
No. I know, I'm like, Google?
You called Jamie Dodson. So we asked Jamie to comment on this, and he said, technically, both are seaplanes. The Goose is a flying boat seaplane. A plane fuselage sits in the water and is shaped like a boat. The Beaver is a float plane, a land plane that has been modified with floats into a seaplane. So, Rob, I guess the answer is the headline of your article. It was just fine.
I think that goes with the whole FAA where, you know, whether what aircraft type and, you know, those classifications. It's still a seaplane because it still goes on water no matter what.
Right. I think that's
it. Right. And all I know is the examiner said, you are now a seaplane pilot. And I went, okay.
Yeah, I'll
works for me.
We have some pictures that Patrick sent in. We're going to put these in the show notes. He said he was taking off from Salt Lake International. He looked down and he saw a strange aircraft sitting on the ramp. So he took a picture. Now, when you look at the photograph without zooming in on it, it looks like, well, you've got some aprons there and you've got some planes lined up. But when you zoom into this one that looks a little bit off, you can see that the ground crew has lined up baggage carts into the shape of an airplane. So from the air, yeah, it is. From the air, it just looks like another one of the airplanes. So we'll put those shots in the show notes. Want to thank Patrick for sending that in. That's definitely humor for the week. I think that it was really fairly clever. I got to give those baggage guys, the ground crew, some credit for that. All right. Well, with that, we'll bring this episode to a close. I want to thank you for listening to episode 319 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com/319. We'd like to thank our guest, Rachel Payne. Rachel, once again, tell our listeners where they can find out more about you and all the stuff that you're doing.
You can actually just Google it. You can type in Fast Aviation Florida, or you can type in hangerswap.com, and that's spelled with an A, not an E.
I always have that problem with spelling hanger.
I know, and I'm like, okay, hanger for clothes and hanger for airplanes.
I know. I get confused. If you'd like to find us or our contributors online, visit airplanegeeks.net. You can find links there to the websites, recent episodes, tweets, contact information, and more for this podcast, Airplane Geeks, but also the Jetwine blog, the UAV Digest, What Just Flew By, Plane Crazy Down Under, and Aviation Extended. And that's at airplanegeeks.net. All right. With that, opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. And join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Blue skies.
Rachel, one of the funny stories you told me is how you were promoting your stuff by putting flyers in the men's restrooms.
I didn't even get to talk about that.
Well, boy, hold on. My point was going to be she should redo the flyer promoting this episode so it could be in all the restrooms.
There you go. Oh, yeah. My gosh. So I was telling Brian, I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the airport. And where do the guys always have to go? It's usually the restroom.
Sure.
And so I put it in like front of the urinals. And then, you know, when you're on the crapper and you're staring at the back part of the wall and it's got grease all over it, I might as well just smack a hanger swap on there. And you probably have your phone, so you're probably going to Google it. You're not leaving the toilet anytime soon. So it gives you something to do. And I had someone call me and was like, yeah, I was going to the bathroom and I saw your flyer. I'm like, yes, it worked.
Oh, man.
You know, we have this little program that we do. Another thing I forgot to talk about, where I send out flyers to people and they put them on the bulletin boards at all the local airports and I send them a Fast Aviation shirt. And we have over 50 people that have done it so far. And like I said, you know, Hanger Swap started a month ago. So they post them and they send me pictures, and then I get people. I had one guy, there was like some pinup girl and like on another ad, and so he like maneuvered the hanger swap so that the hanger swap was right underneath the girl covering the other ad, but the girl was still there.